So my name is Nicoline Joubert. I'm from South Africa. I'm a psychologist by profession. Been in private practice for more than 40 years. And I work a lot with traumatized people, families, children. I did go to the States. I lived there for a while and worked for Houston Christian University as a full-time professor. I'm still working for them online, so I'm still involved with Christian psychologists in the U.S. So if you have questions about that, I'm involved with the Christian Psychology Society in the U.S. Yes, I'm married, I have 5 children, 2 grandchildren, and I speak Afrikaans at home. So I have a South African accent. If you don't understand my English, just let me know. A lot of the information will be about Ukrainian displaced persons. It doesn't mean that the issues and the mental health risks do not apply to any other refugee or other displaced persons. In the world, it is quite a crisis at the moment because we have millions of displaced persons, forcibly displaced by war, violent crime, other issues, poverty, and a displacement causes a threat to mental health. So as Christian counselors, psychologists, and specifically the church, we need to take note of how we can minister and serve this population group. So the question is, how can we as Christians share the love of Christ with people who have suffered such significant losses? I think one of the problems, and you guys can contribute to the conversation, but if you haven't worked with this population, you're not aware of this population, it's difficult to understand what they go through, how many losses they encounter. And we will speak about that, the list of losses. So what do we need to know? We need to know how serious this phenomenon is, how serious this situation is for people that are forced to move, to flee. And what practices can we implement to serve them best? So I will look at the definition of displaced persons. They're not asylum seekers. They're not migrants that are by choice migrating. They're not immigrants. They're forcibly displaced persons. They can be internally displaced or externally. So in their country or forced to leave their country and go across borders. And it is the result of collective trauma. It's a big event that's traumatic. Can also be a natural disaster, but a big event that hits a country force people to flee their homes and their familiar environments and move somewhere else. That's a part of the definition. Understanding the type and extent of loss, I think that's really important for us to understand that or try and understand that. And then strategies that you can implement to serve them. And what is lately also being used is technology. The role of technology is quite helpful in this field, and I'll get to that later on. So traumatic events are defined as extremely unusual and shocking events that's life-threatening. And it can involve man-made acts like war, ongoing violent conflicts like tribal wars, acts of God, natural disasters, things like bushfires, tsunamis, etc. And like I said, it threatens the mental health of millions of people. And it's not only that population group, because they are threatened, their movement into other countries start to threaten the stability of the countries that host them. So it's not easy for any country in the world just to host like a million newcomers and say, okay, we'll give you shelter, we'll give you food, we'll give you jobs, we will provide. countries are obviously very involved in this, most countries, all countries, because it's in the benefit of everybody to help displaced people and not to create huge mental health issues. So what is the call of the church? The church is the family of God in the world. And the call of the church is to witness and proclaim in every circumstance the meaning of God's love in Jesus Christ for every person. And that's the challenge the church has in this environment. If you that have worked with refugees, you know how difficult it might be to go and proclaim God's love in Jesus to them. They will find it difficult to connect with that. And the church is called to remain faithful through its ministry, to also to interpret the signs of the times, to make sense of it, and to try and not explain to refugees, but try to help them find meaning or make sense out of it. And the love of the church for refugees is a sign of the love of God for humankind. So it's an extremely important ministry, in my opinion. It is a unique ministry, and it should be viewed like that. It's a mission field in the sense that we are called to minister in a practical way. We are called to serve those that are in need, to provide food, shelter, love, care, relationships. And this is a population group that need that in a very specific way. So the definition is persons who have been forced to leave their homes and countries. It's a unique group of civilians. And the biblical perspective is to view Christ in the stranger and the needy, to say Christ is in your midst. If you have a person coming from this background, say it's Christ. And there's a scripture, for I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Matthew 25:35. And the scriptures are very clear about how we treat strangers when they're in our countries. Love the sojourner, therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. The scope, what is the scope of the crisis? I'm going to give you a few stats on this. And so that just to, that you can realize how big this is. The scope of the crisis of displacement is emphasized by Reichman, who stated that 82.4 million people worldwide were forcibly displaced in 2020. 82.4 million people. These stats are all official stats. So you can look it up. I'm doing research in this area, so I've looked up credible resources. Lawson et al. Stated that it was predicted that the Russian invasion would lead to 4.5 million refugees. Even before Russia invaded, they predicted this. It was predicted. Okay, if Russia is going to invade the Ukraine, there will be at least 4 to 5 million people displaced. The war in the Ukraine resulted in the fastest growing refugee crisis since World War II, with more than 10 million people being internally displaced or displaced across borders in the beginning of April 2022. So now it's already 2024. But that is what's going on. And in the beginning, the Ukrainians fled but moved back. There was quite a movement of leaving the country and going back home, either to check up on home or make sure where the husband is that's now that joined the army. But that movement in and out has stopped, or it's very diminished, because so much in the Ukraine is now devastated. There are no food, there's no nothing. So that we don't get that movement anymore. People that flee do not return. And I think you should think in terms of the population group, the effect on the men that has to join the army, have to join the army, the women and children, they suffer actually the most, according to all the research, and it's they without protection. And many times children are unaccompanied, so they suffer in another way. But men also suffer because they don't know what's happening at home. They don't know what's happening with their wife and their children. Displaced persons experience extreme stress due to loss of their residence, loved ones, and change in external environment. And there's some research about, especially with children, losing a routinized, a familiar, secure place of living with that routine. So they go to school, they come back home. So that routine is security and safety. And then they lose all of that. They also lose the routine when they have to flee. So for the first time, the EU has implemented the Temporary Protection Directive since World War II because of this crisis. The crisis is so bad. Many Ukrainians cannot access services and protection, especially against gender-based violence. Technology provides a new form of support, and I'll show you a little bit more about it later. And then the ultimate impact of this displacement in Europe is unclear. It's not, because it's still ongoing. So it's not clear how it will change the landscape eventually in Europe. So I've already mentioned that the impact on mental health is severe. Anxiety, stress, poverty, depression, isolation, hopelessness, suicidality. There's a study done on the unaccompanied children that fled in Ethiopia and how they started to commit suicide because there were no parents with them. So the suicidality rate is just rising in those children because of nobody there to look after them, basically. So secure attachments are threatened and replaced by the development of anxious and avoidant attachment patterns. Another study looked at people that were forced to flee but were tortured. And there was a lot of violence and they were tortured, specifically being tortured, and how that affected attachment styles. And they did not become avoidant, they became preoccupied, just like they were constantly seeking reassurance, not completely avoidant from people, but trying to find security by anxious way, of course, but preoccupied with that. It's estimated that 1 out of 3 refugees is affected by depression, anxiety, and PTSD. So how can we ask questions? How can we engage with refugees or displaced persons to learn more about their experiences? And I have examples of questions here that I want to give to you and want to emphasize. If you build a relationship with a displaced person, it's important to ask questions about their experiences, not try to move your own assumptions and biases out of the way. So listen to their experience. Ask questions about attitude. How did you feel? A behavior. What did you do? And knowledge. What did you know? And you will learn quite a lot about that person's experience, because you will say, can you tell me about the time when you were forced to leave your home and flee? So it's try to get the context and what made that person realize, I must flee. Because the news of the invasion was out there and not everybody packed up and leave straight away. So what happened to convince them or help them make that decision? How can you describe what it was like trying to access shelter during the conflict? How did the journey impact your relationship with your family? Because some people flee with, women flee with their children, sometimes with their mothers or sisters, other family members, older person, elderly people, and that will impact their psychological being, you know, their mental health, because they must also care about them. So another type of question is, what did you do? So what did you pack first? where did you go? How did you decide on the route? And what did you do when people in your family group or the group of people that were fleeing were expressing severe emotions like crying or freezing up and they can't move or, fear? I get panic attacks. What did you do? And then what actions were taken upon arrival at the shelter? So people will not just, if they come to counseling or if you counsel them, they will not spontaneously start to speak about all these experiences. Because part of it is shameful in a sense, or they find, or it's too deep, it's too painful, it's actually too painful. So it's very difficult to speak about it, but if you can gently help them speak about it, it will help them express those emotions. And then the last section is questions related to knowledge. So what did you know? What factors influence your decision to leave? Or thinking about the Ukraine, did you know where the Russian army was when you decided to leave? Where did you think the army was? What knowledge did you have? And because if you can understand the context of that person, the fear of that person, the decision-making process, getting out of the country, you will understand much better what that person is struggling with when you do the counseling. Okay, so what can Christian counselors do, or how can the church act? Active listening and empathy should be paired with biblical compassion. So that will take you a long way. If you just listen, you show compassion, and you listen actively in terms of making eye contact and just reflecting on what the person is saying, no interpretation, and just maybe direct the person to the compassion Jesus felt. So Mark 1 verse 40 to 41. Now a leper came to him, imploring him, kneeling down to him and saying to him, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Then Jesus, moved with compassion, stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I'm willing, be cleansed." And again, this is not to say to anybody in this kind of crisis, all we need to do is pray. It is to say, this is the level of the compassion Jesus has for people that are struggling, that are ill, that need help. And there are other examples. Jesus wept, John 11, verse 33 to 35. When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. So the examples from scriptures showing the compassion of Jesus are good examples to use to convey compassion, the compassion and love of Christ. What is compassion? So compassion is a sensitivity to suffering in self and others. So if you come as the church counselors, you need to have that sensitivity to the suffering that these people go through. That's why I mentioned earlier on, if you have assumptions about refugees or biases, you have to deal with that first. But you cannot go into their trauma world and show compassion if you actually have like an unconscious bias of some sorts. So it has to be based on empathy. So mentalizing what the other person feels. So you can show empathy, active listening, and then just try to mentalize, think, what is this person feeling? A commitment to try and alleviate and prevent suffering. And that you can do by asking, "What can I do for you? What do you need?" I think a really important component where the church can come in is the relational process. Because even if refugees see your clinical psychologist, your clinicians, that's a very specific, formalized relationship. It's not a friendship. It can never be a friendship. And they, like I've explained earlier on, they come into this situation, into this shelter, with a list of losses. And those losses include people and relationships and a community. So now they're in a new community and they're new and everything is different and they're in pain, suffer with loss. So a relational component, just to build a relationship, just to be a friend, just to come around and say, how are you doing today? Is there anything that you need? Just on that basis will change the world in terms of not being isolated, not being alone. Somebody cares. So that, I think that's an extremely important component. Compassion is that awareness of suffering. So it's cognitive, attentional. It's also this sympathetic concern related to being emotionally moved. So if you meet with these people and you start a Bible study, for instance, let's do a Bible study together, you cannot be emotionally numb. You cannot just be cut off and show no emotion or feel nothing. You have to emotionally connect with them. And you need to have a wish to see relief of suffering, even if it's just in terms of that context, the new context, that they know that there are people that will visit them and help them or support them. And you need to have responsiveness or readiness to relieve suffering. That's a motivational component. So there are different strategies. We always start with practical support in the case of an extreme traumatic event. We always look at your first responders, your psychologists, your counselors, people coming in, nurses, medical doctors. It's always firstly about basic needs. Do you have shelter? Do you have food? Do you have clean water? Do you have sanitation? How can we help? On a basic practical level. Once that is more established, you can start to work on other types of relationships, like I've mentioned, and bringing in something like education, for example. It's very difficult in a refugee shelter for children to get a continuation in education. They often lose a year of education. And people can come in, church people, can come in to help with teaching and educating specifically smaller children and doing play groups and doing some recreational activities for them. So then we can move to another level of needs, and that will be the spiritual level of needs, where you can come in with Christian faith interventions to help them build resilience. And I already mentioned that Bible study groups can be good, or church services can be good to help them build resilience. So these are the hierarchy of needs, Maslow's hierarchy, it's very well known. But you can see that the bottom level, that's where we start. We start with the physiological needs of a person. Then safety, personal safety, employment, resources, health, property. Employment is a big issue because people come in, like I said, it's mostly women and children. Women coming into a refugee shelter are traumatized and maybe has been violated, but now they also is responsible to take care of the children and find employment. So they're responsible for earning money. And that employment, to find employment is quite difficult for refugees. Sometimes they find employment, but not at their level of training. maybe just a lower type of employment, and they do it to earn money. Then from there you move to the other levels, like friendship, intimacy, family, sense of connection, then to respect, self-esteem, you build that up, and lastly self-actualization. When a person is really established and losses are more processed and relationships are in place, you can really start to speak about more about the future, more about what do you want to do from here. It's interesting to note how refugees, if they have the option, choose host countries. They can choose where they want to flee to if they have an option. Sometimes they don't, but sometimes they do. And they choose places that have some connection to. Either there's a family member, or there was a family member, or they've been there, or they have a friend there. So they tend to go to a community where they think they have a connection, or they can build a connection, because they've lost everything. So it is really huge, that aspect. And I think as a church, we should really come in and cover them with love and just acceptance, and on a basic level, just start to come in and say, you're not alone, and what can we do to help you? So strategies. Now, I mentioned the losses, and I think part of the treatment has to include grief counseling. Some of it can actually be done by a pastoral counselor. I mean, pastoral counselors do help people grieving and help them through that process. So if it's about the grief, then even pastoral counselors can help. And there are two models basically, and one specific as a type of grief. The TASK model is a model by Warden. I'll explain it now. The stages model is the one that's very well known, Kubler-Ross. You go through all the stages. Most people know that, and I think pastoral counselors are trained in that. But then you get your prolonged and complicated grief expressions, where people really cannot process the losses. They just overwhelm. There are too many and it's complicated. For example, if someone goes missing in the war, say a woman's husband goes missing, she had contact with him and then suddenly no contact, she doesn't know where he is, the army cannot tell her anything, that becomes complicated. Do you grieve? Is he dead? Is he alive? Where can I find him? So that type of grief, that type of loss, becomes more difficult. Or if there's more than one loss on the journey, that is more the work for a clinician. But if you get all your other losses, you can really help people to start to work through losses if you just apply the stages model or the task model, which I will talk about now. Something that was put in place for the Ukrainians is technology and the tech community really come to the party, so to speak. And free mobile phones were given to Ukrainians. But there were also things like apps that were created for Ukrainians to stay connected to information about what's happening in the Ukraine, what's happening in the war. Because the information is not coming out. And the information is not always trustworthy. That's whatever we read in the news. So if you can imagine, if you out of the Ukraine, you fled and you're out, but your husband is in the war and you have no contact with him, and you don't know what's happening, you don't know where the battles are, that will cause a tremendous stress and worry. So if there's an app that you can at least go to and there's some information that's trustworthy source, you can get some kind of information, you can follow what's happening in the Ukraine. But it can also provide mental health information, just little small in tips on how to stay calm, how to do relaxation techniques, or where to seek help. So if you feel you get panicky, there's a number. So an app on a phone can help a lot. Technology can actually help a lot. Confidentiality may be an issue here, because the question will be, how is the information protected? And that has to be considered. So the stages model, that's the stages model. I feel fine is denial, it's not happening to me. Anger is why me, it's not fair. Bargaining is to people still bargain with God to delay something or hope they can get something back. Depression is, I'm so sad, why bother with anything? Depression is a real risk. And like I said, anxiety is a real risk. And suicidality is a real risk. Acceptance will take a while the war is ongoing and the losses are still there. You're not easily going to get there, but you might help a person to accept, for now you're in this shelter or in this city and it's temporary, but you have to function. You need to do what's necessary to function well. So you can get a level of acceptance. And then the task model, it's a little bit different from the stages. It has to do with tasks that we should achieve while mourning. The first one, accept the reality of the loss. So if a family or if a mother and children has fled the Ukraine or any other country and the home is gone, you cannot return to that home, that city. You can help her to accept that reality, the shock and the denial, to start to accept, because the hope will always be there, I'll go back home. Process the pain of the grief. Now, this aspect probably will need more professional counseling, because you want the person to express the pain of what they've lost. And the third one, the church can help, friends can help, adjust to the world without that old home or the old life. Not necessarily the person, if the person is fighting in the war, but you can help with that adjustment. And that's where all the practical help comes into play, like doing a language course, finding a job, getting education for your children, and that brings stability. The moment you can help somebody to begin to adjust, and like she said, start to cope on your own and start with a new life in this new environment, there's more stability and more security. And the risk for mental health disorders go down. Complicated or prolonged grief is when people fail to grieve, when they just can't. They can't grieve. They can't even express their emotions. They cannot get over the historical factors. They keep on speaking about it, or they keep on denying it, the reality of it. And that can become chronic, the sadness, and it can go on for a very long time. And this type of grief needs professional help. Now, that's just a picture of technology. What I didn't mention earlier was that there was an Israeli virtual hospital that was opened in 2022. Also for the Ukrainian people. And through this virtual hospital, you could ask advice, mention symptoms, get some advice. So I think that's also a good idea, especially when you cannot reach a hospital, cannot access medical help. You cannot ask anybody, there's nobody to ask. Even if you go into a shelter, there are only so many staff and not necessarily trained medical staff. So if there's a virtual hospital, you can ask questions. The whole issue with this, with the virtual forms of help is confidentiality. So Now, this is my conclusion, and I think this is why we have a voice. John 3:16, for God so loved the world, everybody, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have an everlasting life. And Psalm 33:22, may your unfailing love be with us, Lord, even as we put our hope in you. And that's where the hope is, in the Lord. And that's what we must pray for, all of us working in this field or having the opportunity to work in this field, that God's love will empower us to work in the field and touch other people's hearts, but also, like you said, influence policy. No, have a voice, speak out.